Welcome back to another episode of the Captain America Minute, where we examine the 2011 Joe Johnston-directed feature, Captain America: The First Avenger, at the rate of 1 minute of screen time per episode. I'm one of your hosts, just a few miles from Kitty Hawk, North Carolina. This is Jim O'Kane of TVDads.com.
And I'm Hal Bryan from the home of the Experimental Aircraft Association here in Oshkosh, Wisconsin, and as I usually say, an airplane nerd.
And I am Brian Feese, a graphic novelist and lifelong Avengers comic book reader.
And I...
You know the drill.
I'm Billy Campbell, an out-of-work actor, a farmhand, and wannabe graphic novelist here in the south of Norway.
Well, it's perfect.
So we've got two guys in the south.
Right. And four time zones covered.
Yes. Wow. Well, Billy, thanks for joining us. And, you know, why not have one superhero talk? Well, superhero, we're going to talk about superheroes here. One superhero talking about another superhero, the Rocketeer himself, Billy Campbell. Thanks for being a part of this. And really, we're here. We have you here not only to talk about superheroes, comic book heroes, but also to give us a little bit of background on Norway. But I think first, Hal, let's go into what the synopsis is of Minute 4.
All right, Jim, Brian. Ollie, Minute 4. This one's waited long enough. There's a chair in the center of the control room. The shield tech wipes snow off the object seated on the chair. "Lieutenant," shouts the shield tech. Lieutenant steps forward with his flashlight. "What is it?" asks the tech. "My God," says the lieutenant. "Base, get me a line to the colonel." Base on the radio replies, "It's 3 a.m., sir." "I don't care what time it is," says the lieutenant. This one's waited long enough. Encased in the ice, the iconic Captain America star and shield is visible. The scene shifts to the past. A town square on a winter night. A young man, Jan, runs towards the church, opens the heavy door and bolts it behind him. The churchkeeper descends a flight of stone steps. "De har kommet for det," says Jan. "They have come for it." "De har dafür," replies the churchkeeper. "They have before." "Ikke slik," says Jan. "Not like this." "La dem komme. De vil aldri finne det," says the churchkeeper. "Let them come. They will never find it." And wow. Scene.
Wow.
Well done.
With apologies to Ollie and everyone else who speaks Norwegian, I just did my best phonetically.
Yeah, Mr. Campbell, how fluent are you?
Valiant effort. Jeg snakker litt norsk. I speak a little Norwegian. Men, you know, jeg lærer. I'm learning. Men det går sakte. But it goes slowly. Yeah. And I've now just spoken all the Norwegian I know.
Well, there you go. I was once stopped on the street in Seattle by a couple of German tourists who were needing directions, and their English was minimal, and it was 1,000 times better than my German. But I told them not to worry because I talk to little Germans and I'm willing to help. And as it turned out, they were both these very short old ladies. They thought that was the funniest thing they'd ever heard. I'm doing my best here. But anyway, I digress.
Wow. That's hilarious. Yeah, well, that wasn't bad. It could have gone better. But I had to look it up, to be honest. When I watched the clip, they came in and they yelled at each other, and I had no idea what they were saying. So don't feel so badly.
That's why God invented subtitles.
Wow. Well, Hal, the only solution to this is you're going to have to move to Norway, and you know, immersion is the best.
I see no other way forward. I got to go trace my ancestry anyway.
Well, we have room in the barn, Hal. There's room in the barn.
Room in the barn. Yes. I'm reminded of a comedy routine I saw by, I think, a Norwegian comedian about how Marvel movies have butchered words like Asgard and Mjolnir, and his larger point was that the few times popular culture deigns to deal with his homeland, they get it wrong. And I was curious whether Billy, you get any sense of that irritation? Have you been in the lawyer long enough to kind of absorb that sense?
Well, I mean, to be honest, Norwegians, I think written in their DNA somewhere is the sort of the stricture against, is that the right word, stricture? Where'd that come from? The prohibition against being too much in someone else's bubble. So, you know, if a Norwegian, how do you know, the joke is, how do you know when two more Norwegians are having a violent argument? Well, they're standing there looking at their own shoes. you know, the joke during the pandemic was, you know, the Norwegians were thrilled when the 1 meter rule was rescinded, because then they could go back to 3 meters. So that, all that's by way of saying it would be very, very difficult for me to register any kind of disapproval from a Norwegian, because it's just undetectable to my radar.
Wow, you just have to watch for minor facial features, twitches, or anything like that, or just like wandering off, I guess.
Something. Wow. Something.
Well, here you are in Norway, and I think we discussed previously sometime. I said that you're kind of the Shane Rimmer of the 21st century. That you are the American guy in European movies sometimes now. I just watched your by the way, a great feature on Netflix. If you get to watch the movie Troll, not the movie Trolls, that's a whole different show.
Yes, but, that's a whole different show.
But the movie Troll is, I guess the only way to describe it is like a Norwegian King Kong meets Jurassic Park. And it's very, very well done. But
terrifically well done. I loved it. Yeah.
And it's fun. It's a great, it's a great old time monster movie. And I understand that there's a Troll 2 coming out. So
there is.
Yeah. And, you know, apparently it's going to be a franchise. So maybe they'll have you back.
I hope so. Survive. That's no spoiler. I do survive. And in fact, the director had at one point said, Ollie, we will love to have you back and your hat. And because they let me wear my own hat, and admittedly I showed up to wardrobe with my hat and kind of pushed for it, and it was perfectly appropriate, but yeah, I did get to wear my own hat, but unfortunately, I guess in the writing of the film, they sort of, you know, I mean, you have to write what comes naturally, and I didn't appear in the sequel, but who knows. Maybe in the threequel.
Yeah, they'll find. I mean, you are playing a paleontologist, so you're up in the hills digging for things. So, you know, maybe they can find some more things up in the hills.
Yeah. Oh, sidebar. As long as we're talking about trolls, one of the funniest movies you'll ever see is also a Norwegian. What do you call docu? No, it's not a docudrama. What is it? What are they
called? Like a mockumentary.
Mockumentary.
Yeah. It's a Norwegian mockumentary called Troll Hunter or Troll Hunters.
I like it.
And they literally in you know, hunting trolls, and it is really, really well done. You honestly get a sense of awe from, you know, tagging along over their shoulders in search of actual trolls. But the guy who plays the gruff, like a very, very terse actual troll hunter that these young filmmakers team up with. He's actually one of Norway's best comedians, most widely known comedians. And it is fantastic. It's one of my favorite films of all time. Highly recommend.
Wow. Fantastic. One other mention about Troll. I was very impressed by the name of your character in that movie.
Yes. Dr. Secord.
Okay.
Was that your choice, or was that?
No. That they did that. Yeah. Wow. The director, Roar, Udhagen, he said, "I hope you don't mind, but we really wanted to name you Secord." And I was like, "Absolutely! Are you kidding? This is wonderful."
They had started by saying Okono, but it didn't quite fit. Now it's in my headcanon now that somehow he's a long lost descendant of Cliff, who moved to Norway to study rock creatures.
I wanted to ask you about Tunsberg, Norway, which is where this scene of the movie is set. It's a real town. Have you ever been there?
I've passed through Tunsberg a couple of times. I haven't spent any time there. I had been wishing to for the last few years. The reason I very first came to Norway was to be a crew, was to crew aboard a Norwegian tall ship, you know, one of those big square rigged sailing ships. And is how I met my wife on my fourth year aboard that ship. But the captain of the ship for 3 of the 4 years that I was on it lives in Tunsberg. And I haven't seen him now since 10 years, I think. And he's just across the fjord. But he does actually pilot ocean liners at this point. And he's quite often, very often away. So we haven't managed to. He stopped by the farm some years ago, but we haven't managed to hook up lately. So I've been meaning to go to Tunsberg, where he lives, and spend some time there, but haven't got around to it yet. It's a lovely town, though. I mean,
I don't suppose you saw a creepy old church with a alien artifact in it,
a blue glow of any kind.
Yeah, if I had seen a church, it would have been lovely looking. They've just tarted it up to be creepy in the movie. Norway is the most like Norman Rockwell place that you can imagine. It's even the crappy neighborhoods are charming. There aren't really any crappy neighborhoods.
How's the beer? I know you are an aficionado. Is Norwegian beer a thing? I mean,
it is a thing. It is a thing. It's a thing I prefer not to drink. I don't mean that Norwegian beer is bad. It's not. But my favorite beer right now is Spanish. Which is Alhambra. It's a gorgeous, gorgeous lager. Comes in a beautiful green bottle. No, there are some very good Norwegian beers. In fact, a couple of decent Norwegian beers made just within, a few kilometers of here. But I'm in Europe. Think of the beers that are just at my, at arm's reach. So, all the Belgian beers and the Spanish and the I don't know if you guys are all beer lovers, are you? Raise your hand.
Oh yeah, I used to be a brewer. Actually, I worked at a brewery.
Oh my goodness,
in Pennsylvania, well, no less. So,
well, I'm in the heart of West Coast IPA country. A lot of small breweries.
I love a good,
here.
Yeah, love a good, as they call it over here, a good IPA. but I so very highly recommend this Spanish beer. Write it down. It's called Alhambra, Alhambra, Alhambra. And you will not regret having found it. Wherever you have to find it, you might have to order it special at the
I think we may have a sponsor now. We have to check in and
see. Oh, my God. Yeah. So,
I have a question for you, and it spins off something I think Jim and Hal and I have discussed before, and it's the idea whether or not the Rocketeer is a superhero or was a superhero, and if you have any insights or connection or feeling about your role vis-a-vis the Marvel Cinematic Universe, Captain America. You were a filmic superhero. How do you feel about seeing other movie superheroes? Do you think, well, I could do that, or I've already done that?
to be honest, I feel a little snooty about superhero movies, to be honest.
Well, you were one of the best ones.
Yes, but the thing is, I don't consider that I played a superhero. I played a normal guy who finds a rocket pack.
That's the question.
Yeah, and from to my way of thinking, the universe of the Rocketeer is not the universe in which there are superheroes. It's the universe in which regular guys find a rocket pack and fight the Nazis. And I would be utterly, utterly dismayed if Disney decided ever to, you know, what do you call, make a hybrid of, you know, the
crossover
crossover of the two universes. I would be dead against that. And not just personal preference, but I think it would not be respectful of Dave's legacy. So I don't think of it. I've never even, you know, back when I was collecting Commandy, Last Boy on Earth, I never collected a superhero comic. I wasn't attracted to them. I'm still not attracted to them. I don't really go see superhero movies.
Yeah. Just a note for our listeners, you mentioned Dave. Dave is Dave Stevens, the creator, writer, artist of The Rocketeer, who was just one of comic book's great talents just on the strength of Rocketeer alone.
And oh, my goodness.
Unfortunately, yes. Passed away at a very young age.
Yes, he did.
Like an incredible sense of the human form and just details. And he was also persnickety, I think would be the best word. He was persnickety about accuracy in history.
Yes, he was.
You could probably find out the street addresses of places that he had put in his comics.
Yeah.
And he was one of the only ones, and I mean, there's only been a handful over the years, but who, and obviously I'm biased and this is my narrow view of it, but he's the only one who always, always, always got the airplane stuff right.
Yeah.
And that's usually one of those sort of the first things to get sort of cast off. Well, nobody knows about that. Nobody cares about that. We'll just scribble some airplane here and stuff like that. And
that's right.
All he knows my reputation as a flea picker, and there are no fleas in Dave Stevens' work.
No, put that
on a t-shirt.
No. And he really, really was very good at boobs.
yes. Yeah. Yes.
Well, another, practiced, I think.
Another favorite topic, apparently.
Well, yeah. And I mean, we don't need to redo the Rocketeer Hour, but and it's obvious to me that you got the role because you had a strong physical resemblance to Dave Stevens. I mean, Dave Stevens could have played the Rocketeer almost.
Absolutely. I mean, the thing that happened was I went. After I got called for the audition, it's a longer story than this, but I'll cut it short. I went to the comic book store. I had never seen the comic. And I went to the comic book store and I wasn't excited about the movie until I went to Golden Apple in LA and I found the book and opened it up and I felt like I was looking at me. Yeah. And I was like, Oh my God. I could get this. And then I became excited about the movie and went and got a haircut and did some other things and got the part.
Wow.
Based on the fact that I looked so much like Dave. Dave and I hung out for a bit after the movie every once in a while. We'd go to his favorite 50s era place to get milkshakes and stuff. And every once in a while, somebody would say, "Oh, Dave, is this your brother?" No, it's he's my creation.
Well, and Dave drew Cliff in many ways to look like himself as well. So when you're picking up that comic book and you're seeing yourself, it's all, it's all three of you guys. But, as we discussed it at length, maybe that physical appearance got you in the door, but, everything else you brought it to life on raw talent.
Oh, well, thank you. I'm most pleased that Dave himself was very pleased.
Yes.
Well, and in my opinion, I mean, you may disdain the superhero label, but I think you, Chris Evans from the Captain America movies and Christopher Reeve have a lot in common in that you play these larger than life heroic characters who are just good to the core and you make them interesting. I think that's a real challenge is to take somebody who's just pure good and make them interesting.
And you did it. And you saved us from Johnny Depp.
Yes, indeed.
Oh, goodness.
But you pulled it off, and I can't imagine. Is that a tough acting challenge? To look at it on the page and just say, this guy has no flaws. What am I going to do with him? I guess Cliff's a little – he's a little hot-headed maybe.
Yeah. I mean, you know, we just kind of went for a feeling, you know? Like puppy dog-ish, eager beaver, and – one other or two other animal metaphors that I can't think of right now, but you know, it was aiming more for a feeling than it was very thoughtful. And you know, Joe was good about that too. You know, Joe, he didn't do a lot of directing. In other words, and Alan had to actually sort of help me out with this arc, and because in the first few days I was a little, you know, it was my first movie and I was a little skittish, and I felt like Joe didn't like my performance or what I was doing, because he didn't, you know, say, well, that was good, you know, as I had experienced before with other directors. And Alan, bless his soul, sorry, I get a little a little choked up thinking about it, but Alan was, you know, took me aside and said, listen, no, you have to understand that Joe is a certain kind of director, and he's loving what you're doing because he's not saying anything to you. He's not asking you to change anything. He's not asking you, you know, he loves what you're doing. And once I sort of relaxed into that, then it was, you know, it was kind of gold.
Basically. Well, to hear that from someone with the history of Alan Arkin too, I imagine it's just meant so much to you.
What a gift.
I can't, you know, say enough about Alan. He was a gift from heaven, and he's kind of a lodestone for me, because, you know, it was my first movie and I idolized him, and they say never meet your idols. But he was the one instance in which, you know, gave the lie to that. He was a gentleman, and he was supportive, and he was funny and loving, and,
I remember seeing a couple of people being interviewed at his passing, and one thing that came out in all of the interviews was that he had absolutely no ego where it was concerned on screen, and he let every other actor get their time in the spotlight, and he reacted to it. So I mean that's probably one of the most difficult parts of acting, because when you're acting, you're trying to be there and be out front and things like that. But letting the other guy get the spotlight, that's a tough thing to do. But it's something that it comes with experience, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, that's who he was, and I have I have tried for better or worse to be as much like him as I could possibly be to everyone I ever work with since. And, you know,
well, I see that in you in watching the Cardinal series, the Canadian detective show. I was watching you and I was thinking, you give an awful lot of time to the other actors that are on the screen. You're not pushing your way toward the middle and getting your scene in. You respond to what they're doing. And I think that you picked up what Alan was laying out.
Well, it's also completely selfish, because the better they look, the better you look.
<That's true>. Yeah. Well, and talk about putting lie to the old aphorism, never meet your idols, Ali. This is the work you did with us on the Rocketeer Minute, and coming and joining us here and the other shows, and just staying in touch and being a friend. What Alan did for you, I don't mind saying you did it for us.
Oh, Albert, well, it's been my joy.
No, it's
quite sincere. Yeah. This is
Yeah, no.
This is a big deal to have you in our lives.
And it's changed. And, yeah, it really has changed. I mean, I can't express this enough how it's changed our shows that you knocked it right up from the beginning of the Rocketeer Minute when you reached out to us. You knocked us up several flights. Right. So many thanks for that.
And I'd be remiss while I'm blowing sunshine around. I mean, this whole connection between Jim and me started because I sent Brian over here a fan letter. And
no kidding.
And I think we've covered that story, or at least we will. We record out of sequence, but anyway. And it's the same sort of thing. I mean, never in a million years picked up Brian's book, fell in love with it, and then just couldn't not send him a thank you note. It was driving me crazy. Never in a million years thought, well, we sitting here side by side working together. And so maybe I'm just lucky.
He's drawn a lot of people whose
work I admire.
To spoil a story, I will probably tell elsewhere on this podcast. You know, Jim and I knew each other from before, and Jim wanted to do the Rocketeer podcast. And Jim contacts me and says, "Hey, Brian, you want to do the Rocketeer podcast with me?" And I said, "Well, you know, I just don't know if I'm going to have the time to commit to that, but I know a guy who flies old planes and has a Rocketeer helmet. Would you like to talk to him?"
It was the call I was waiting for 20 years. You know,
that's fantastic. That's how shit happens. Excuse my language. Yeah.
No, he hit the big red button on the wall and the microphone dropped down and the rest is history.
And I stood tall with my arms akimbo and I accepted the challenge.
Oh my god.
But anyway.
While we're here in the middle of a Joe Johnston production, and you were saying that Joe, if you're doing okay, he's not gonna talk to you. But
he's not gonna mess with it. If it's good, don't f with it.
Yeah. So I know that the last episode we did of the Rocketeer Minute, when you revealed to us that you were secretly recording the Rocketeer animated series.
Yes.
After keeping mum for so long, while we were not holding it against Jolly, but but I remember one of the things that you said was you really enjoyed doing voiceover work because they were basically giving you line reading. It's like, say it like this and we'll do it three times till we get it right. And it's like, you were directed into the ground with that one. It was like, I love this. And then you could, you know, go stop at the pub and drink on the way home.
Yes.
I'd like to point out that my reading of the synopsis could have benefited from that. Thank you very much.
I will happily give you line readings, Halbert.
All right, next time I'm not doing it cold.
My understanding is that actors tend not to like line reading. Somebody tell me how to read a line. That was fun for you to kind of get that.
It is
get fun. In, do the job, and get out.
Yeah, but I mean, then again, that was voiceover for a cartoon. You know what I mean? Yeah. Like I don't have an image I can watch. I don't have anything. That I just have them to give me a context. But to be honest, I wouldn't mind it even on a set. I think that also depends. I know for a fact that Ang Lee, who is a great filmmaker, right? Who did I have? Was it JC? Was it Jennifer Connelly maybe? Did an Ang Lee movie?
Yes. Yeah. She did Hulk, right? Was it?
Yes, I think that's right.
Yeah, the Eric Bana Hulk, right?
I think it was she who told me that Ang Lee, if I'm getting this story, it's in the fuzzy back region of my head, but I think it was she who told me that Ang Lee directs, he directs like, okay, Ollie, you're going to pick up the pencil. When you pick up the pencil, pause. Grab the pencil, look at it, say half of your line, then look away to the left, say the other half of your line, then look back to the pen, and then touch your head with it. Right? I mean, literally like this. And I was like, I said, how did you deal with this? And she said, you know, you just have to surrender. You have to surrender to it. And I'm not a guy with, you know, a whole lot of anything in the way before I surrender. And so if I was doing a movie with Ang Lee, I would be absolutely be happy to be directed in such a way. If I were doing a movie with a director I didn't think was very good, I would not be happy being directed like that. In fact, I you know, yeah.
Don't tell me what to do, Ang Lee.
Yeah.
Now, Ed Wood, on the other hand.
Yeah.
Well, what have you ever done, Ang Lee?
Yeah. People, oh, said that about, yeah. People said that about Kubrick, too, but they were very happy to work with Kubrick, you know?
Well, that's what I mean. If it, you know, Kubrick or Ang Lee or any of these, if I should ever be so lucky as to be able to work for anyone like that.
Well, you were directed by Doug Trumbull, right? For that... that
Call in Space?
Yeah. Wasn't
no Doug Trumbull?
No, there was that hyper. That was like hyper. It was a thing that they filmed Brainstorm with. It's the hyper speed 60 frame a second film.
Yes, that's Showscan.
Showscan. That's
called
what it was.
Showscan. Yeah, but that was not direct. That was a short. It was not directed by Trumbull. That was Trumbull's process.
Right.
But the film itself was directed by great director. I was thrilled to work for him, Richard Fleischer.
Oh, wow. You know, okay. Yeah.
Yeah. Who did Soylent Green.
Right.
And,
yeah.
Oh my gosh. So many. And, what a wonderful, wonderful man he was. And he told me an amusing story. Sorry, I'm going to go off on a tangent.
No, this is fine. This is what we're here for.
A really amusing story where he was directing George C. Scott in Europe on the Amalfi Coast, way up high on a, driving on a road, cliffside road. And George Scott was driving this red sports car and Richard Fleischer was hanging onto the hood with one hand and with a camera in the other, shooting George Scott through the windshield. The thing was, he was convinced that George Scott was royally pissed off at him and was trying to dislodge him and throw him into the Mediterranean. And he said that George Scott, I can't remember what movie or what his dialogue was, but apparently like Scott was bellowing at him like, "You mother so-and-so, I'm going to put you in the screech cage," like this.
Wow. So anyway, instead of Patton, he would have been in an Italian jail.
Exactly.
Well, and one more question on voiceover work. When you were doing, when you were reprising your role as Outrageous Okona, did you have a similar director style for Star Trek? Did anybody tell you line meetings, or did you just mostly, let's try that line again? Or
what do you mean, for the cartoon?
For the cartoon,
for Prodigy.
For Prodigy.
Yeah. For Prodigy, it was a similar thing. I didn't get to see footage or anything. I don't think I got to see footage. I can't remember. Wow. No, it's been so long, but I've never seen it. I should look it up and have a look at it.
You can find it, because it's not on Paramount's dropped it, and it's part of Nickelodeon, but I don't know where it's available.
Oh, I bet I probably can't access it over here. The thrilling part of that job was they sent some recording equipment over, pouched it to me, along with a brand spanking new PowerBook. And I had this PowerBook. And I did a few episodes and stuff, and then, you know, this PowerBook is sitting on my desk, and then I'm for weeks and weeks and weeks, and nothing happens, and then I finally write to them, and I'm like, "You guys want the equipment back?" And they're like, "Nah, just keep it."
Oh wow!
I got a brand new PowerBook out of it. Yeah.
Nice. That's wow. Cool. Very cool. Yeah.
Since Jim brought up the Outrageous Okona, I have a totally self-indulgent question. He can cut all this if he wants.
No, it's fine.
I'm a Trekkie, and I loved you in that episode. Everything wrong with that episode was not your fault. You might have discussed this in the Rocketeer podcast, but a woman named Junie Lowry Johnson had a big impact in your early career, I think. And I was just wondering talk about her a little bit and you know, how she guided and shaped your early career? Because most people who are listening to this probably have no idea who she is.
Oh, I call her Junebug, and she's got that wonderful Southern accent or Oklahoma accent, whatever it is. Anyway, one of the very first things I did in town was a miniseries called Dream West. Her brother Hunt Lowry was directing, and so I got to go to Colorado and work with Richard Chamberlain and play a Civil War soldier, which, you know, I came from Civil War reenacting back in Virginia. So it was a thrill for me in many different ways. But she got me more jobs over my career than any other casting director in town. She and her producing or casting partner, Libby Goldstein, with whom I'm still in touch. And I adore them. I mean, she just, I don't know. She called me up and said, do you like Star Trek? And I said, well, I love Star Trek. She said, there's going to be a new Star Trek series and you're number one. And I said, what? She said, yeah, there's going to be a new series. It's called The Next Generation. And I think you're number one. And I'm like, what do you mean? Like, what's the lead? And she said, no, number one would be the right-hand man to the main character, the captain. And I was like, what? I would be like second in command of the Enterprise. And she started laughing. Sadly, well, not so sadly, actually, to tell you the truth, I got into the process and I got down to, you know, like pretty much the final meeting, and it was just the two of us. It was me and I'm blanking now.
Jonathan Frakes.
Jonathan. It was Jonathan and me. And we're sitting, you know, outside that big room at wherever the studio was, and Junie's in there with like 12 studio executives, and calls Jonathan in, and he comes out afterward, and I'm just sweating under my armpits. And ever the gentleman and wonderful person, Jonathan shakes my hand and says, good luck in there, and walks out the door. And I walked into that room and I bombed. I bombed. I was so bloody nervous. I turned into a block of wood, and I felt so badly about it. I looked back at, I caught Junie's eye, and she was just kind of like, you know, looking like a, I don't know, a wet hen or something. And I can't explain it. I just bombed. I think I was afraid of so many things. One of which was like suddenly the prospect of, I knew the thing was going to go for years and years and years, and maybe that was part of it. I don't know. I think I got cold feet, but then again, who knows where the nerves came from, but they came and they attacked me, and I left, and I was mortified. And of course, Jonathan got the job. He should have got the job. He was the better man on the day. But some months later, I called and tried to, you know, to apologize to Junie, because I'm like, I'm so sorry. I left you with egg on your face. I was like, she was talking me up as the guy, I think. And she said, oh, honey, it's fine. She said that Jonathan is wonderful. Everyone loves him and it's all good. I'm not angry at all. And I said, well, does that mean maybe I could do an episode? He said, you want to do an episode? I said, yeah, my God, all I ever wanted my whole life was to be on Star Trek. And she said, I'll call you back. She called back the same day and said, I got it for you. So that's how I got the part.
That's, well, a great story.
Anyway, Junie has cast me in more things. The Killing was one of them, which was one of the best projects I ever got to be part of, and that was up in Vancouver. And
did she get you in the 4400?
I think she did. I think that was Junie.
Yeah, I think she was kissing on that.
Yeah. But bless her heart. She was really, really, really something for me. Is really something for me. I adore her. Yeah.
One last question about we were talking about the world of superheroes and the world of not superheroes, that of which the Rocketeer is not in the Marvel universe. Could you see the Rocketeer with Indiana Jones?
Hell yes.
Yeah. That's
The same universe. That's you know, it's not superheroes, and it's a little supernatural elements of it, you know, of course, the arc and everything, but absolutely.
Disney has even, Disney has even sort of quietly suggested that. If you go to Jock Lindsay's Hangar Bar in Disney Springs, it's based on, you know, a fictional thing based on Indy's pilot with the Waco float plane at the beginning of Raiders.
Oh, no kidding.
And Jock Lindsay, so that character in the Disney universe now, was hanging out at Bigelow's Air Circus and going to Chaplin Field in 1938. There's little subtle posters and artwork and thing that suggest that there's some crossover there. Yeah, I've got a couple of little, you know, faux felt pennants in my hangar and some stuff like that. So they penciled that in at some point. They just decided, these guys would have crossed paths.
Yeah, I love that. That thrills me. It gives me a special feeling.
Yeah. In fact, Jock Lindsay's Hangar Bar is the only place I know where you can go and steal coasters from the South Seas Club, even to this day.
It's at Disney Springs.
Disney Springs in Orlando.
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Florida. Okay. And they have the coasters say South Seas Club on it with a big S.
Oh, my goodness.
I have an extra one, Ollie. I'll send one to you.
I would love one. I haven't been to Orlando, Disney Orlando in 35 years or something, probably, or more. So I think there's a lot. Last time I was there, I what is the Epcot or isn't there a, there's like a circle with, and you can visit many countries around this lake.
Yeah, that's part of Epcot.
I got drunk right around the world. ended up in the English pub with the Guinness. I don't think I ever made it past the Guinness.
Well, you had your pants on for that one. I'm like, well, people have to listen to the Rocketeers for the Rocketeer Minute for the story of Comic-Con.
No, I did not take my pants off at Disney World. Okay. No.
It's good to know you're still allowed back. Wow.
Well, on that note.
Yeah.
Well, Ollie, thank you so much for being on the show. It's always great talking to you. And every time we're here, more and better war stories of the entertainment world.
I have more of them.
Oh yeah, we'll get you on again, I'm sure. So everybody stay tuned. I'd also like to thank the audience and thank you for joining us. If you'd like to continue the conversation, we're always available at Camp Lehigh, the Captain America Minute listeners base on Facebook. If you do like our show, don't forget to subscribe and leave a like at the podcast streaming service where you found this episode. Also, please check back on our website, capminute.com, for the latest about our podcast topics and guests. And be sure to join us here next time on the Captain America Minute.
I can do this all day.